Hello and welcome to the Honest Politics Podcast. My name is Alex Gamsik and I'm the founder of Honest Politics LLC. My company does high-level political consulting but not for politicians. My services are for everyday Americans just like you and me. So let's get started with part three of the Constitution Project, as I like to call it. We're going to go through strong and fair elections, which is this section. There's three amendments here. The first of which is automatic voter registration. So the provision here is to protect an individual's right to vote, and each state must register every citizen to their voter rolls within 1 year of their 18th birthday. I think similar to how all males are required to register for the draft on their 18th birthday, or within a certain time frame of their 18th birthday, everyone should be required to register to vote. And states will be the ones monitoring and registering people, because I think there will be some mistrust of the federal government putting everyone on the voter rolls, and the founders intended for the states to be running elections in the first place. So the states will send literature to people's houses on their 18th birthday. They will encourage them to vote, and by encourage, I mean they will be constitutionally mandated to do this. Just how we are mandated to register for the draft, we should be mandated to register to vote. The text within the Constitution that I propose would also protect every individual's right to vote, unless there's certain things, like if they've been caught committing voter fraud in the past, or if they're not actually a citizen yet. Stuff like, you know, very simple things. If they're under 18, you can't vote. But otherwise, everyone should have their right to vote protected within the Constitution. And if everyone's already registered to vote, it'll make voting easier, it reduces a barrier to voting. It just makes sense in my opinion. Next, we have abolishing the Electoral College and establishing ranked choice voting for federal offices. So this has a lot of benefits. If you have ranked choice voting, you see something like you had in the caucuses in Iowa, where there will be fewer negative attacks because politicians will want to be people's first choices. They'll want to be people's second choices. If you want to be someone's second choice, you're not going to attack their first choice. So there's going to be more positive campaigning, and it'll increase civility in the political discourse. There will be more political parties because there's more than two choices on a ballot. I think this will all, it won't just create three parties. I think there'll be multiple parties vying for that third or second or first position. So it can decrease this us versus them attitude, and it can increase more of a who actually is the best political party or the best figurehead for the moment that the country is in at the moment. You know, it's a more accurate reflection of people's preferences. Getting rid of the Electoral College, it just makes sense, again, because what we're essentially doing is going state by state and electing people who are basically bound to vote how the state voted. It's such like an arbitrary process when you think about the actual process itself. And some people say, oh, this makes it more representative of the whole country, you know, because presidential candidates are going to Ohio or Wisconsin, places they wouldn't normally go. But think of all the places they're not going. They're not going to Wyoming, North Dakota. They're not going to New York. They're not going to Maine. They're not going to Arkansas. You know, there's only like 6 to 10 battleground states that these presidential candidates are going to. And it just like underrepresents the process when those 6 to 10 states elect the president for the entire nation. Getting rid of the Electoral College is important to also add my provision that I talked about on a previous podcast, where a president must spend 72 plus hours in every state in the nation within a year of being president. And I think this would decrease the, you know, the problem where presidents only campaign in 6 to 10 states. They would have to visit every state. That takes away the argument that the pro-electoral college people have. I think this just makes sense to change the way we elect presidents and make it so that they are more representative of the entire country, not just a few battleground states. So next we have the last of these three, which is fair electoral districts. In my reasoning, I just said this makes elections more fair and competitive and gerrymandering, simple as that. And then the process with which I said to end gerrymandering was not simple at all. I said something about how the Supreme Court unanimously selects 9 members of a federal board of electoral districts, and then that board hires their own staff. That board establishes state electoral commissions, and they manage the electoral commissions, but the electoral commissions of each state manage their own electoral districts within their state. And my design is kind of complicated, and it probably should not be in the new constitution now that I've had a couple weeks to think it over again. I think we should just include a couple of the provisions I had. Some of them were saying that each state must construe fairly equal in population districts. These districts must resemble ordinary polygons, I meant to say regular polygons, and or be drawn upon clear natural borders, such as pre-existing county lines for up to 15 or more years, mountain ranges, rivers, and interstate highways. This clause must be interpreted as reducing irregular shapes designed for electoral advantage. Whenever you're coming up with a complicated idea like this, it's best to throw out a ton of ideas, see which one of them stick, narrow them down, and then clean them up. I think I'm still in the narrowing down phase with this one, but I think making sure that electoral districts either look like regular polygons or draw upon pre-existing either natural or county lines or state lines makes more sense than some of the craziest looking electoral districts that I'm sure you've all seen pictures of if you closely follow the news. I'm gonna go ahead and do part 4 because that was a short part. This new part I am less sure about than the other 4. It says new enumerated powers. So I'll go through these quickly and why I think they need to be in. The first is to institute or regulate methods of insurance relating directly to health and property. So insurance is a commodity unlike other types of commodities because it requires a collective pool of people to invest in order for it to work properly. And especially with health insurance, everyone's going to need to use insurance at some point, but no one can predict when it will happen. Just think of the coronavirus. Think of yourself in, 2018, 2019. Who would have predicted the entire economy would collapse? And 70 plus thousand Americans at this point have unfortunately passed away because of a virus that was generated late in 2019 and spread across the world extremely quickly. You need health insurance to stop something like that. And it's completely unpredictable. It's hard to wrap your head around how unpredictable it is. Or, you get in a car accident. You can't control when you get in a car accident, really. It just happens. If someone else is drunk driving on the road, you can't control that. I'm still researching health policy. It's something I'm kind of new to compared to some of the other policy areas. But I do think the federal government in the new constitution needs to control externalities better that cross state lines, because externalities cross state and national lines much faster and more effectively than they did in the 1700s. So I'm going to take a quick commercial break and I'll get back with the rest of the new enumerated powers. Next, we have a solution to immigration. Well, the framework for a solution, it's complicated, but it says to enact citizenship for anyone with a demonstrated dedication to the United States. So this makes the new immigration system based on citizenship. I think the whole immigration battle, this is an opinion again. This is all a personal project by me, this entire podcast, just so you know. I think it would, and again, it's something I haven't researched heavily, but I think adding citizenship would solve this problem quicker than most other solutions, where you make citizenship easier to attain, and then once people are citizens, you strictly enforce the law, like we do with all other citizens. So you're not just detaining and releasing illegal immigrants back somewhere they can sneak back across the country again, because that doesn't make sense. And it also doesn't make sense for someone who's lived, worked, and been a beloved member of the community for 25 years to be deported. Like, there has to be some, not just middle ground, but fix to the system. And I think if you made people who are, I said demonstrated dedication to the United States, give them citizenship. And that leaves the political process to interpret what demonstrated dedication to the United States means. But I think given all of the other provisions in the Constitution to speed up legislation, it will produce the best or at least a workable solution. The next is to ensure that every child has a quality education. Now, through my schooling at American University in political science and public policy, education is always the foundation to people either having better health, better wages, better relationships. It seems like education is the foundation upon which every single aspect of your life can get better. It's important that we make sure that every child, meaning every person under 18, has a, quote, quality education, which again leaves that up to the political process. But it's kind of clear from this that we should not having some states or some towns or some zip codes within a town to have horrible public education systems where children don't even have safety in their schools. And then other school districts that are basically better than private schools because they're so well funded. And it just doesn't make sense. We need to have a more equal playing field so that every child, I'm not saying every child should pass all their exams and we should be patting them on the back every time they fail a test, you know, but we shouldn't be having some children picking their textbooks up third hand from the richer schools, which get everything brand shiny new, and you're a member of the debate team and the United Nations team and the robotics team and all this stuff is open to you, but in other schools it's not. There's a disparity of where the starting line is, and it's not fair at all. It all just depends on your school's funding, which is funded by property taxes. So if the people in your surrounding area have huge luxurious houses, they'll be paying a lot into the school district. If there's not very wealthy people surrounding the school, there'll be much lower property taxes and the school will be much more underfunded. I think the federal government needs to start fixing this inequality in education. Next is to ensure high-speed internet. I did this purely because in the Constitution it says we need post offices and roads, but the post offices and roads of today are mostly over the internet. Think of information sharing, think of communication. And right now you're seeing in rural areas where they don't have great internet connection, that lowers their ability to retain people. That's why partly why you're seeing people go to urban areas. It's reducing their access to telemedicine, to advanced technologies. And it would just be better if we guaranteed high-speed internet because it is the post office of the 21st century. Next, we have three that are nature slash animal inspired. So I know that my biases are getting into this, but I think they're still very important for the federal government to intervene in because I see them as really big externalities that the founders may not have thought of during the 1790s. The first is to implement sustainable pollution limitations, land use regulations, and wildlife protection for the preservation of long-term environmental health. So the planet Earth has boundaries, planetary boundaries, and we are starting to exceed those boundaries by introducing tons of phosphorus and nitrogen into our water systems, by introducing tons of carbon dioxide and nitrous oxides into the atmosphere, by literally driving millions of animal species into extinction. To stop all of this is important. And I don't think the founders would have thought that the planet Earth would be exceeded by human intervention, especially because they had just discovered two entire continents. They didn't even really understand the entire Earth yet. We have to, in this age of modern information, where we've pretty much discovered a lot of the world, even like, you know, we haven't been to the depths of the oceans and stuff quite as much as we have. But the places where humans can plausibly inhabit the Earth, we have explored it. We are on a different level of influencing the planet than they were in the 1790s. We need to do something to limit ourselves so that our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren have a habitable place to live. Not to mention that a lot of these things are negatively impacting us now. So when I say the preservation of long-term environmental health, that includes the next year, the next 5 years. Next is to respond to extraordinarily damaging feats of nature in coordination with the states affected. So this means that if there's a huge hurricane that spans multiple states, it should be a federal as well as state responsibility to deal with it. If there's a pandemic virus, it should be up to the federal government to help solve it, not just leaving it to the states, because viruses do not respect state boundaries. Should be simple enough. And then to establish basic human responsibilities of humans towards animals. This one is harder to justify on a the founders would have wanted it framework, but the way the founders, in their day when food was raised, it was basically, like a family owned a bunch of chickens and goats and stuff, and then you killed them yourself, and then, you ate them, stored them in salt vats and all this kind of stuff. Now we have factories where chickens are hung up by their feet, and a machine will slice their throats within seconds, and it's just like everything's so mechanized and on such a grand scale, and the suffering we more understand now as real. And it's not like they lived a nice life on a farm. They've been cramped in cages or stuffed into hugely densely populated pens their whole lives. Like pigs can't even turn around in a lot of these cages. They're stuck facing forward, standing, doing nothing their entire lives until, chop off your head. So we should have at least basic humane responsibilities. And I put that in the United States Constitution. Some people may disagree with me, but I think if you polled a majority of people, they would say that we should treat animals better. Thank you for listening to parts 3 and 4 of the new Constitution. My name's Alex Gamsik. I'll see you next time as we seek to discover more of the stories behind the statistics.